This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
People are not going to protect what they don't know and they don't love.
When was the last time you were really in the wilderness? Or maybe you're like the millions of Americans who've never even been in the wild before. This week on Sea Change Radio, I have a wild discussion with Jason Mark, the editor of Earth Island Journal, as we honor the 50th anniversary of the passing of the Wilderness Act of 1964. Mark shares his misgivings about what he views to be a technological threat to some of nature's most mysterious spots, and how much of our wild is already pretty tame. Then we delve into conservation policy and talk about the surprising number of bipartisan conservation bills that, unsurprisingly, have not yet been passed by Congress. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jason Mark. He's the editor of the Earth Island Journal, and he's also publishing a book next year on wildness in the 21st century in America. Jason, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's really great to be on the show again.
You recently penned a piece for the American Prospect about Google Trekker, which is this, if anybody has used the Street View setting in Google Maps, it's very cool when you're trying to find a location and you can actually see the building you're supposed to be going to, but they've taken this into the wilderness. Why don't you explain a little bit more about the technology and maybe some of the trepidation you have about it?
So Google Trekker is Google Maps' idea of, exactly as you said, extending Street View to the backcountry. So far they've done the bottom of the Grand Canyon, they've mapped the Colorado River, they've done portions of Volcanoes National Park in Hawaii, as well as Angkor Wat and some other places. They've got this essentially backpack-mounted camera array. It's a 40-pound unit that they can either mount on, you know, on a person's back or on, I guess, a tripod on a raft, and then take it to very remote places. And I guess in some ways it's kind of a nifty idea, right? I mean, it offers, say, perhaps somebody who's disabled a chance to raft down the Colorado River, which they would never be able to do. It might have some real-world applications for conservation biologists, right, who want maybe a visual baseline of some ecosystem. But
education too, I imagine, right?
Education for sure. You know, I can see where some wildlife or wilderness organizations might see a real benefit in this. American Rivers, for example, which is a really great environmental nonprofit, partnered with Google to map the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So there are some real-world applications in which it's useful. I worry, though, that it removes, it sort of erodes part of the wilderness character. That is, a place that's untrammeled by man, where man is a visitor who does not remain. Those are the words from the Wilderness Act of 1964. And it seems to me especially important in this era in which I think a lot of us are feeling a kind of more acute kind of digital or technological claustrophobia, right? Knowing that so much of our online activity is always monitored by big corporations who want to sell our data, perhaps monitored by the federal government with all the Edward Snowden NSA revelations. Don't we want to keep someplace that's really off the grid and off the map, someplace where we know that when you go there, you really are outside the bounds of civilization, and that's what it offers us.
What was that quote in the article from Leopold, who talks about the best parts of the map are the blank spaces? I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, no, there's a great Aldo Leopold, who wrote Sand County Almanac and is one of the, you know, real giants of environmental ethics, wrote, he said, "What good are 40 freedoms without some blank space on the map?" And this has always been a little bit of the wilderness ideal in terms of what does wilderness offer us as a little bit of an escape valve. I mean, the wilderness has been a really important refuge for centuries for political dissidents, for fugitive slaves, for misfits like Henry David Thoreau, someplace where you can get away from society if that's what you feel you need. And we don't want to lose these freeholds of the unmapped. I think it's really important for us as a society to know that there is some place that's away. You know, there's something good about knowing there's something that is outside the bounds of our day-to-day life.
Is it just the disappearance of that mystery, or do you think that these mysterious places will disappear?
I mean, I'll agree. This is sort of a subjective complaint, right? I mean, this is, and you could even say sort of an esoteric complaint. But yes, I think one of the things that wild nature offers us is a little bit of a sense of mystery and magic, right? It's that childhood wonderment, wondering, whoa, what is this flower? What is this butterfly? What is this critter that's out there in the woods? When you are out in wild nature, in a true wilderness area, you have the acute sense that you're outnumbered by the critters and that most of the action is passing unseen. And I think that's part of why we're attracted to wild nature, why we have what, you know, the Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson calls biophilia, this hardwired love of nature. There's something about the mystery that we like. And I worry that Google, in their quest for omniscience, are going to sort of suck some of that mystery out of the place.
The thing that really resonated for me with the piece was near the end when you talked about how it's hard to really appreciate wilderness today as an urban dweller myself. I have little secret spots that I know in Yosemite, but I'm always kind of doing it kind of in the gray area of the law. I try to get my wilderness pass. I want to do the right thing. And I know that the people at the Park Service are probably horribly underpaid and really overworked, and their intentions are very pure and that they want to preserve these beautiful treasures of our planet. But I still can't help but feel the pull to want to go to my own little secret spot and enjoy it without getting a $250 fine or whatever.
Sure. I mean, I do think this is one of the, as I mentioned the piece, our American wilderness system is pretty tame, right? There are laws, there are boundaries, there are rules. And as you say, there's good reason for all of them. And yet, it is to me a little worrisome when, boy, if you had the good luck of spotting a wolf in the Gila wilderness or spotting a wolf in Yellowstone, there's a pretty good chance it's going to be wearing a radio collar, which there are some perhaps good reasons for that. But in the same way, it does sort of undermine, again, this sense of the wilderness character.
That this wolf has already encountered man.
Right. This wolf has not only encountered man, it's thoroughly in the matrix as much as you are. It's being tracked. Its movements are being tracked and recorded, just like perhaps yours may be if you're a person of interest to the NSA. I mean, again, it's a little bit of a strained analogy, but it is true. And so I do think it's especially important now in a world where it feels like wildness and wilderness are more than ever endangered places and endangered commodities. We need to hold on these last scraps of wildness as a little bit of a touchstone for our relationship with non-human nature.
When we talk about camping, though, as city dwellers, you and I, in the Bay Area, so many times it's these designated spots that you're going. It's car camping, basically. You're just getting out of the city is pretty much. You're not really, you may be in nature, but you're not in wilderness.
You know, I think as we've talked about on the show before, I co-manage and co-founded an urban farm here in San Francisco. I believe very strongly in the importance of what I call the nearby nature. That's, you know, our regional parks, our state parks, our more wild city parks, that those provide people a really important way to connect with a little bit of wild nature and to get a little taste of it. I do think at the same time, though, we don't want to lose the importance of the remote wilderness, and that's the place beyond the end of the road. There's a great quote from Senator Frank Church, who was senator in the 70s and was really instrumental in protecting a lot of wilderness areas in the Northern Rockies. And he talks about how if you don't have a place where the road ends, you have no wilderness. I mean, again, it gets back in this idea of what are the benefits to us as individuals and as a society to a place that really is beyond the reach of the motor and the engine, where, yeah, eventually you're going to drive to some remote place. And from that point on, it's you and your 2 feet, or maybe you, and if you're lucky enough, your pack mule and your horse, but there's no motorized equipment. There's no motorbike. There's no ATV. And I think we need those places as a spiritual resource. And then of course, as a biological resource, just to leave some space on the planet for other flora and fauna.
Up among the firs where it smells so sweet, or down in the valley where the river used to be, I got my mind on eternity. Some kind of ecstasy got a hold on me, and I'm wondering where the lions are. 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 I'm wondering where the lions are.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the editor of Earth Island Journal, Jason Mark. It's a little bit off the topic, but I can't help but think of the movie Into the Wild as maybe a cautionary tale that steered people away from the wilderness. I actually was a colleague of the young man who died. He went to college with me at Emory. I can't remember his name. I didn't know him, but he was like a year ahead of me or behind
me. Chris McCandless, I believe.
Chris McCandless, yeah. He was like in my class in college. And so I just saw the story unfold. And I think it's an important lesson for people to not be cavalier about entering the wilderness. But it was such an extreme case. I think it may have been an overly cautious tale. Do you agree?
I think, you know, the Chris McCandless thing is so interesting, and as John Krakauer notes, I think in the preface to one of the new editions of the book, it's like a Rorschach test, right? People look at that story, and they think the guy was a romantic hero or an idiot, and very few people sort of see as in between. So, yes, it was really kind of a polarizing tale. I think the lesson is you have to, I mean, certainly it's the old Boy Scouts mantra, right? You want to be prepared, but I think it's important to anybody who is planning, especially making a wilderness expedition for the first time, to remember, as the poet Gary Snyder says, that wilderness is a ferocious teacher, and the lessons you learn there can be brutal. I have done, I continue to do a lot of solo backpacking, but I'm certainly very cautious all the time to leave with my family or my partner information about the trailhead, where I'm going in, when is my expected return.
Explain the reason why you would go solo into solitude.
That's a great question. What are sort of the benefits and the needs of solitude? I mean, I don't know. Perhaps I'm just a little bit of a loner. I feel like it's what solitude offers. And of course, you could find solitude by going and, you know, I guess meditating in the Zen center, right? And find a kind of solitude there in the middle of the city. But I think what solitude in the wilderness offers is, you know, it's like the blank map of the soul. You have nothing there, no other sort of ego or consciousness except for yourself that you have to grapple with. And the wilderness is and always has been a retreat for self-seeking. I mean, think of all of, not just Western religions, Eastern and Western religions, right? Siddhartha goes into the wilderness alone and has his meditation in which he becomes the Buddha. Jesus of Nazareth goes into the wilderness alone. Moses goes into the wilderness alone when he's confronted with the burning bush. I mean, it's sort of, you were talking about Jungian archetypes. The wilderness is a place where we go to either encounter or confront something divine or mystical. I mean, that's an ancient pull within many of us. And not everybody. I mean, some people find solitude to be terrifying, but for those of us who find it restorative, we want to have those places.
By romanticizing McCandless, it's not that big a leap to see why we would, because of some of these great heroes of religion and history have been drawn not just to nature, but to solitude.
Yeah, and I think we do want to be careful about that romanticizing. I mean, I think, you know, the ideal of wilderness that we have today, it's a modern construction. We've given a word to a thing that for most of human existence didn't have a word, right? In indigenous cultures, there's usually just the people, meaning that nation or tribe, and there's just the world. There is no wilderness. Wilderness doesn't become a concept until the creation of agriculture, and then suddenly there's sort of the human-dominated places, and there's everywhere else. If you really look at the etymology of wilderness, what it means is self-willed. That's what it means, or wildness means autonomous. It's something that's not controlled or dominated, and essentially not controlled or dominated by people. And for most of our history, that was a scary thing. And it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution and people started to see some of the downsides of human creations that the Romantics, and then American Romantics like Muir and Teddy Roosevelt, started to appreciate the wilderness. But we have to be careful about that romanticization, because it also has got some negative connotations. I mean, I think the most obvious one was the way that Native American peoples were sort of erased from the land and the story. We're going to make a park here, so we got to get all the people who live there out of the park, right? There are some dark sides. And so I think, you know, in this year in which we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, the trick is, how do we start to create an ideal of wilderness that's both ironic and sentimental, that's self-knowing and heartfelt at the same time, where we sort of understand that it's a construct, we understand the sort of dark sides about, you know, having moved indigenous people off the land, and we can still find that sense of rejuvenation and still have that celebration for, again, taking some part of the world, and it's really just a little part of the world we're talking about here, and saying this is off bounds to human intentions.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the editor of Earth Island Journal, Jason Mark. Jason, I want to turn to more policy-oriented discussion in a second, but I still wanted to discuss trying to grapple with the idea of wilderness from a less privileged standpoint. You deal with urban farming around the Bay Area, so you're very much attuned to what's going on in economically starved communities, food deserts, and the like. How can somebody like an 8-year-old underprivileged kid in inner city Oakland get to experience the wilderness? And is there a chance that that boy will be able to? And what are the best routes for somebody like that to become one with nature to appreciate it in a bigger sense?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say, you know, for communities that are under-resourced and poor communities, there's all sorts of ways, again, to engage with that nearby nature and find a way, as you put it, to be one with nature, even in the regional park or the state park or the local more wild city park, let's say parts of the Presidio here in San Francisco. Luckily, there's a growing number of different programs that are geared towards getting kids in the outdoors, basically coming from this idea that we've got a whole generation that's suffering from what author Richard Louv has called nature deficit disorder. I mean, kids just don't really know much about natural ecosystems in the natural world. So I'm really pleased that there is a whole movement of folks that are determined to get kids either into the nearby nature or into the remote wilderness.
What about Google Trekker?
Google Trekker could be a way of giving a little bit of a taste. I will acknowledge that. I think this is so important because, right, people are not going to protect what they don't know and they don't love. And of course, we've got a rapidly changing country demographically and ethnically. And the stereotype of people who go backpacking are, you know, old, gray-bearded white guys.
Or
ladies. And we don't want to have an environmental movement or a wilderness appreciation movement that's a bunch of, yeah, old white folks trekking through landscapes that most people don't even know exist. So I'm really glad there are all of these programs. There's a really great woman across the bay in Richmond, Rue Mapp, who's got a group called Outdoor Afro. She's working with getting mostly African-American communities more engaged with wild nature. And there's all sorts of groups like that. So, I'm cautiously optimistic that we are seeing more engagement with our national parks and our wilderness areas that does reflect the face of the country.
Shenandoah, I love you, don't go away, rolling river. I'll take across the water, away, bound away.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the editor of Earth Island Journal, Jason Mark. So let's talk about the efforts that are being made to protect some of these areas. You already referenced that this year is the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act from 1964, which eloquently described wilderness as areas untrammeled by man. I was shocked to hear that there are several bipartisan bills that are on the cusp of being made law, but for one reason or another, they're bipartisan in the truest sense, and that the conservatives are actually looking to be true to their name and conserve some of these areas. Why don't you give us some examples first?
Well, I mean, the really wonderful thing about the history of wilderness protection in this country is that it really has been a bipartisan effort, right? I mean, our national park system and some of our most important national monument system, the Antiquities Act, was all established under Teddy Roosevelt, right, who was a great outdoorsman. And we still see, especially in the hunting and the angling communities, the fishing communities, which probably skew a little bit more politically conservative, a really deep, profound respect for wild nature and wild lands. You know, again, spend any time in you know, I guess a quote unquote red state, and you're going to see a lot of people who go out hunting in the wilderness, which is a permitted use. You can go hunting in a wilderness area as long as you can walk in there on your own 2 feet, or with your pack mule. And so for every year from 1964 until the last Congress, there was one or another or many wilderness bills passed. And traditionally, you saw a great deal of bipartisan collaboration. You'd see like Barry Goldwater, the arch conservative from Arizona, partnering with Mo Udall, the arch liberal from Arizona, on protecting wild lands in Arizona. It was really something that was part of our shared heritage.
So explain what kind of environment the Wilderness Act created for those kind of bipartisan bills.
The Wilderness Act, when it was passed in 1964, was signed by Lyndon Johnson and was passed with a Democratic-controlled Congress, but certainly with a lot of support from Midwestern and Northeastern Republicans who really understood the importance of this to our national heritage. The last Congress, the 2010 to 2012 Congress, was the first Congress since 1964 not to pass any wilderness bills. And that is really worrisome because it does suggest that perhaps the bipartisan commitment to wilderness has been eroded. I'm glad to say finally this Congress has got around to designating a new wilderness area in Michigan. And as you said, we have this term several bipartisan wilderness bills on the docket. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee is spearheading the Tennessee Lands Act. A Republican congressman from Illinois, I forget his name right now, is co-sponsoring a bill to give added protections to the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. You've got bipartisan bills in Washington and in Colorado. Again, places where people see that not only does wilderness offer us all of these very real kind of intangible spiritual resources, but it's also, especially in a place like Colorado, I mean, it's an economic driver. That's why you see both Republicans and Democrats in Colorado sponsoring wilderness bills, because a lot of the economy of Colorado is based on outdoor recreation. And they know that these are going to provide real gains to their communities.
But a lot of the new money flowing into Colorado is fracking and the natural gas industry.
Sure.
Is that one of the reasons why some of these bills are not being passed?
I mean, I've talked to people who work in Washington, D.C. and work for places like the Wilderness Society or the National Parks Conservation Association. they feel like really the leadership in Congress just doesn't see much of a priority for this, and that's why it's not getting through, even though you have these bipartisan bills.
What do they see a priority for is the next question.
Right, well, that's a good question. I mean, essentially, the bipartisan consensus on almost anything is broken. I do think this Tennessee bill with Lamar Alexander is probably going to get through by the end of this Congress, and perhaps a couple other ones. The bill
he's pretty senior and well-respected moderate.
He's senior, right? Well-respected, and the Michigan bill that went through had a Republican co-sponsor as well, a Republican representative from Northern Michigan. I do think, though, you make a good point. There are increasing conflicts between public lands conservation and the oil and gas boom that's happening across the U.S., and we're really seeing it in places, as you say, like Colorado, Utah especially. There's some incredible lands in the Green River watershed that's called the Tavaputs Plateau, and it's on the dock for wilderness designation, but you've got a lot of new oil and gas fracking happening on those BLM lands. So these conflicts are real. There are real tensions between economic gain and preserving our shared heritage. But, you know, then I'm also reminded of another quote from the novelist Wallace Stegner. He said, if we only protected those places that had no economic value, we wouldn't have any parks. I mean, at the end of the day, there's going to be a tough choice to make between what we value more. Do we value oil and gas more, or do we value the ancient heritage that we've inherited?
We always talk about jobs. That seems to be the core argument from one side of the political spectrum or the other. But then you just mentioned how in Colorado, of course, they need these wilderness areas because there's jobs, there's economic gain. Explain the other side, and from just a cold calculus standpoint, what is the economic benefit of roping off areas from development?
Sure. I mean, I forget what the exact statistic is from, I think it's called the National Outdoor Retailers Association, but that's, you know, it's REI and it's North Face and Patagonia and the ski making companies and the ski resorts. I mean, outdoor recreation in this country is a multi-billion dollar industry. And in some places, like say a Moab, Utah, I mean, it's the basis of the economy, right? It's tourists coming in to appreciate wild splendor or natural splendor. And again, some of those are car camping people and some of those are more wilderness folks. I know that I was down in the Gila wilderness in March, tracking the Mexican gray wolf for part of the book that I'm working on. The small towns in Catron County, New Mexico, I mean, they are essentially sustained on the revenues from hunting, from the hunting season. I mean, their whole economy is based around the fall hunting season. Some of those people are hunting in National Forest Service lands where they can take, you know, trucks into, but a lot of people are going into the wilderness on pack trips to get it game that they wouldn't otherwise access. And again, that's an ancient way of engaging with natural systems through the sort of ancient art of hunting. And those are whole towns that are sustained by that outdoor recreation. So it's a multi-billion dollar business that's sustaining all sorts of communities across the country, and especially in the American West.
And more importantly, that money stays there.
That money stays there. Yes, you don't really have a lot of chain stores in you know, Michigan's Upper Peninsula or in the far outer lands of New Mexico. Local businesses are what you got.
Or conversely, you'd look at an oil and gas company that would come in, extract, move on, buy their mansion in suburban Houston or wherever.
Exactly. And extract is exactly the right word. The profits are the resources, and as well, the profits are extracted right out of that community or that bioregion.
Jason Mark, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's really fun. Great to be here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Wayne Shorter, Bruce Coburn, and Bruce Springsteen. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast.
Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.